Ladies and gentlemen, we are back. We are up on the Logos Media 2 feed tonight. After going on Alex Jones' show, my interview with Alex Jones was pulled and my live stream on the main channel shut down. I appreciate all of you who subscribe to the backup channel today. We had about 250 or so people subscribe to the backup channel. That was very helpful. Unfortunately, they still won't unlock the super chats on the chat thing on this channel. The other channel had about a half a million hours a year of view time, and they're quibbling over, I don't have 4,000 hours of view time in the last year on this channel. So, right now this channel is without Super Chat, but we did get subscribers and people notified that the show is over here tonight. So thank you. Also, thanks to Andrew for sending the banner behind me. I really appreciate that. Big help. Also, please go to the Logos Media website to send any donations. I was not able to link the Patreon account to this now for whatever reason. I will post that in the chat so people can go to the logosmedia.com website and donate to the show. So this is part three that we are doing on our series on Islam. Today we're going to be covering slavery and women and related topics. Hopefully everything is working okay on the audience side of things tonight. Please let me know if you can all hear the show in there. There's only about 10 people in there. You know, it sucks when you go from 60,000 subscribers on one channel down to 1,000, but it is what it is. Lloyd, welcome back to the show. Good to have you back.
Thank you, Jan. Good to be back.
And so where do you want to begin? Let's just dive in. We've got a lot to cover tonight. So,
okay, well, if there's any questions from anyone in the audience about last week, they're welcome to ask that. Otherwise, the main thrust of my discussion today is Islamic slavery. And of course, that's also Islam's treatment of women and black people, African black people.
And I, you know, like the last two episodes, I presume this one is going to be very triggering for many people. We have been providing primary documents on screen. I want to thank only Abu for providing his documentation. He was the only one that was able to come up with cogent arguments. Rebel Lion, I appreciate you showing up tonight. I know you had to set your alarm to get up for the show. Rebel Lion has probably things to add to the show tonight. Also, Bahare, thank you for being so kind and the only one who was considerate in the chats over the last couple of shows that we covered this topic. I know you may not agree, but I encourage everyone to check the citations. Whether or not you agree with what we are discussing, or if you're a Muslim, etc., just please go in and check the citations and documentation for yourself. I think that you'll find that everything that Lloyd is presenting is verifiable. All right, go ahead. Let's dig right into this. Let's kick off with Islamic slavery. Whites and Christians are blamed for the history of slavery. They ignore Montezuma was killing up to 8,000 slaves a day just for his coronation. They ignore Islamic slavery. They ignore that slavery didn't end in Peru until the 1960s. 50s or 60s? I think it was 60s. I think it was the 1950s in India. But there's this whole ridiculous notion that whites are to blame for all slavery and everything else. And we're going to keep it on topic tonight. Thanks, everybody. And if you don't keep things on topic in the chat, you're going to get put on timeout.
Right. Yep. Just by the way, I may touch on things like the Crusades. I may touch on other aspects of Islam as well. Things that can be expanded later, but this is the main thrust of the discussion. And one of the reasons I chose it is that slavery is an issue that is used to shame the West. It's used to shame Westerners. And I feel it is time that we do start to look at something that a slave trade that went on for four times longer and was anything up to 200 times bigger than what we call the Atlantic slave trade. So, yeah. Okay, so if no one's
posing... slavery is still active in some of the Islamic countries today, especially with Slavic slaves coming out of Russia, etc.
That is certainly true. Okay, so I wonder, should I share my screen and then we can...
dig right in, go for it.
Yeah. Okay, so this may be a fairly lengthy section. We're going to cover some history. I'm going to discuss some of that. And then I'm going to... Actually, I don't have to share it right yet. So I will discuss some historical aspects. And then I will start digging into the scriptures and the doctrine, which clarifies a lot of that. So Ibn Khaldun is essentially the most famous historian in the Islamic world. And he wrote that sub-Saharan Africans in the Arab slave trade were submissive to slavery, and specifically said, therefore, the Negro nations are, as a rule, submissive to slavery, because Negroes have little that is essentially human and possess attributes that are quite similar to those of dumb animals, as we have stated. Okay, this is written in the Muqaddima. So that's Ibn Khaldun, Khaldun. So, moving on. Now, something that is commonly used, especially in my debates, and is I hear that Islam is intolerant of enslaving human beings, that Islam eradicated slavery, Muhammad was an abolitionist, and so on. Reza Aslan and others have made this claim, and I've heard this claim repeated endlessly, and I wanted to verify if this was the case. Now, we know, if you look at the myth versus the truth, Muhammad captured, he owned, and he sold slaves. The Quran explicitly gives slave owners the freedom to sexually exploit their slaves. Islamic law, the Sharia, is littered with rules concerning the treatment of slaves. Now, some of these rules certainly can be viewed as humane, but not one prohibits the practice of slavery. Now, the presence of these rules would seem to condone and legalize slavery in Islam. Also, add to this fact, Muhammad was an avid slave trader. So after providing ample evidence of, if we go, so later on, we will look through the Islamic doctrine, look through the scriptures, and we're going to provide as much written evidence from the doctrine as we can to show you just how much Muhammad was involved in the slave trade himself and Islam's legal rulings on the matter. So Muhammad captured slaves, he sold slaves, he bought slaves as gifts of pleasure, sexual pleasure for himself and for his friends. He received slaves as gifts, he used them for work. And the Sira, which is his biography, is very clear on the issue of slavery. Okay, even the very pulpit that Muhammad preached Islam from was built by slave labor at his directive. So the Quran tells Muslims to emulate the example of Muhammad, who was the most exalted character, who was the ideal Muslim, perfect man. So this is what Muhammad did. This becomes Sunnah. This becomes what is allowable, permissible for all time. So now slavery, because of this, has been a tradition of Islam for 14 centuries, including the modern plight of non-Muslim slaves in the Sudan, Mali, Niger, Mauritania, Libya, where there are open-air slave markets today, and other parts of the Muslim world. So if you have any questions or comments, Jan, please feel free to interrupt.
No, and what I want to say is for the audience who has questions, please post them in the chat and we'll deal with them as they come if they're good questions.
Yeah. So, low estimates are over 20 million Africans alone were enslaved. Right? And that's a low estimate. The estimates run up to 80 million. So I'm going with the low estimate. You have 20 million Africans alone enslaved. 6 out of every 10 black boys between 8 and 12 that were taken were castrated. Okay, 6 out of every 10 black boys between 8 and 12. The caliph in Baghdad at the beginning of the 10th century had 7,000 black eunuchs and 4,000 whites. This is from Ronald Siegel, Islam's Black Slaves, The Other Diaspora. Interesting book that covers that topic. Islamic Slaveholders, Untitled by Lord.
Hold on, let me just interrupt you there. Were you intending to share screen? Because you're not.
Should I do so? Okay, finally. Actually, let me do that.
Yeah.
If you think it'll help.
Well, okay, you know, with all of the attacks we've been getting for this series, we better make sure everything is on screen here for everybody.
Okay, you can see my screen?
I can see your screen, yes. And okay. It's coming up for them right now.
Okay, so I just cited Ronald Siegel, Islam's Black Slaves, the Other Diaspora. So the Arab-Islamic slave trade also ushered in the European slave trade. The Portuguese got their start as middlemen for Arab-Islamic slavers. The Portuguese were transporting African slaves along the African coast for them. Right? Also, Arab slavery sparked one of the largest slave rebellions in history. This is called the Zanj Rebellion, and this was near Basra in southern Iraq. And this happened over a period of 15 years, from AD 869 to AD 883. Now, the harsh treatment of Africans in salt mines involved over 500,000 slaves and free men. Right. So these are things that people can go and look up. So these are references people can look up and see for themselves. Now, Islamic slavers often avoided teaching Islam to blacks to justify enslaving them. It was against their interest to convert them. Now, something that which I do mention in the text is that often, if you look at America, the way that blacks are converted to Islam, they get told that Islam is the religion of black people and Christianity that of white people. Yet Islam has a horrible history of enslaving black people, far worse than anything that happened in the West. So Islamic slavery is the longest, it is also the least discussed of the major slave trades. It predates the Atlantic slave trade by 700 years. It even continued up until the 1960s. And in fact, Mauritania criminalized slavery only in August of 2007.
Wow.
So now some slaves were granted freedom. Sure. And this is something that Islamic apologists will throw out. But then so were American slaves. Many American slaves also became men of wealth. In fact, a large number of black Americans owned slaves and were themselves wealthy due to the slave trade. One of the earliest slave owners in the U.S. was a black man, but that's a different topic. So Arab Islamic slavery was not limited to Africa. Slaves were taken from all racial groups. Now, I will go into more depth to some of these points as we go through the text. During the 9th and the 10th centuries, in fact, most slaves were Europeans, not black. Now, we know that the Arab slave traders took anywhere up to, if not more than, 1.5 million European slaves from North Africa and took them to Arabia. Sorry, took Europeans to North Africa and Arabia. Now, the numbers move between 1.25 million to 1.5 million. There may be more, but those are conservative numbers. Those are the numbers that can be verified. Now, what is interesting is that if we look at the number of blacks that were taken from Africa across the Atlantic to North America, we're looking at 350,000. And yet this 1.5 million goes unremarked. Okay. Now, points of interest. There's never been an abolitionary movement within Islam. And I have to ask why. Why has there never been? Abolition came out of Christianity, came from Westerners like William Wilberforce, but we'll get to that.
Yeah, white Christians actually led the charge against slavery, which is another thing that is very seldom discussed.
Correct, and I feel that these are points that people need to start looking at. Now, there was so much material that I had to condense. I mean, it was difficult to decide what to include, what to exclude. But we're looking at a slave trade that lasted 1,300 years versus a slave trade, the Western slave trade, which lasted only 300 years and was ended. So Westerners were the last to enter the slave trade and the first to end it. In fact, the only culture to ever end it. And in fact, they forced other cultures to end it as well. So the abolition of slavery was imposed in the Islamic world by European countries, right? And so along with all this political pressure, this was unrelated to Islamic law, because if Islam is so moral, why did it never end slavery? How come it has such a long history of over 1,000 years? So now, although all this is well documented, there's been no shaming of the Arabs, there's been no shaming of Islam, as in the West, nor has there been an apology. The West often grovels and talks about, oh my God, we're so sorry for slavery. So now the absence of guilt would lead some to think that, okay, well, slavery wasn't so bad under Islam, or, you know, that we have nothing to feel guilty about. However, what this actually shows is that the absence of guilt is a sign of the tolerance that Islam has for slavery. The fact that there's no guilt means that it actually tells you, well, they don't care. They don't see it as a sin, as a crime against humanity. Now, the caliphs were with the religious equivalent of the popes. They often maintained harems of hundreds, often thousands of young girls and women captured from lands as far away as Europe, okay, for sexual slavery. White, blonde women were the most popular slaves, because they were the most desirable, the most attractive, and therefore the most expensive. Okay. Now, Hungarians were hunted like animals by the Turks. The Turks took 3 million Hungarians into slavery over a 150-year period in the 1500s and the 1600s. Why is there no discussion of that? Again, we hear endlessly about 300,000 to 400,000 slaves that were taken to the U.S.
I want to add right there, too, very quickly. The Serbs were also hunted and brought into slavery, and it was the Serbs who really took the brunt of the force to keep Islam out of Europe. And then, of course, Kosovo Bosnia were actually overtaken by it.
Yeah, so these are points. I mean, people can go look this up and start looking for themselves, you know, start hunting around. Now, the Hungarians, as I said, hunted by the Turks. In India, now, India is, man, it's a subject entirely on its own. It is known that the Mughals, I believe, the dynasty, the Islamic dynasty in India was called, they wiped out 2/3 of the Hindu population of India at one point. But anyway, that's a separate topic. Again, in India, 200,000 Hindus were captured and transported to Iranian slave markets between 1619 and 1620. So now, African slaves were often castrated by their Muslim masters, right? Few survived to reproduce, which is why there are very few blacks in the Middle East. There are almost no blacks in the Middle East. Now, if you look at the U.S., you've got 30 plus million blacks who are there now, who are the descendants of those slaves that came across to the U.S. What also is not discussed, if you look, 15 million slaves left west from African shores, went west to the Americas. 350,000 to 400,000 went to North America. The other 14.6 million went to South America. That also does not get discussed. 14.5 million black slaves went to brown South America. Why is this not discussed? You know, why the endless focus on North American slavery? So now, there were 1,300 years of Arab slave trading, and there was only 300 years of European slavery, and this was eventually ended because it was felt to be a moral crime, and aberration, an abomination, and a crime. So now, something I want to note when they talk about the castration of African slaves is that if you look at Quran 24:31, right, I can click on the link and you can see that this is real. Should we actually go there? You can see this is right here. And the word slaves appears, so that is there. Say to the believing women that they should lower their gaze and guard their modesty. They should not display their beauty or ornaments except, and here we go, and one of the categories of people, their husbands or their fathers, their husbands' fathers, and also all male slaves free of physical needs. These are men who've been castrated, and thus the women can display themselves in front of these men because these men are free of physical needs. Now notice the language is euphemistic. Males free of physical needs. Well, they chopped off, they removed your penis and your scrotum. That's why you are free of physical needs. And this
so
might
it
have
wasn't
happened.
Just, you know, it wasn't just castration, it was full removal. Wow.
Correct. You understand? Now, in some cases, it might have, but yeah, this was the case. Okay. So understand that this is where this. So sometimes the Quran or the other Islamic books are written to present a prettier picture than actually is the case. Okay. So we have to be very careful of the translation we use.
Let me just interrupt you. Somebody is saying in the chat, no, it only means older men.
No, there is a reference to actually older men in some of the texts. That actually does come up as a separate category. But male slaves free of physical needs, that is what it says. And you can go to the tafsirs and you can read that for yourself. But even the tafsirs are themselves a little confusing there. So anyway, we have spoken now. We have 30 million blacks now in the U.S. They've got a higher standard of living than their African peers. I mean, America is a wonderful country, so one has to wonder, you know. So let us now look at something that is not commonly considered, is the Irish slave trade. These are the forgotten white slaves. So the majority of the early slaves in the New World were white, okay? Between 1641 and 1652, half a million Irish were killed by the English, and another 300,000 were sold as slaves. So Ireland's population fell from about 1.5 million to 600,000 in one decade, right? Irish slaves were treated worse than, as far as we know, any other slaves in history, right? Many people
and,
now.
And when I bring this up, you know, people say, oh, Jan is lying, you know. But yeah, I mean, this is well known. Well, I mean, it, you know, known by some who actually care about facts anyway.
Yeah. Look, one can debate what's worse, but slavery is bad. Now, let's draw the line. Slavery is bad. Okay. But many people today will avoid calling the Irish slaves what they were. They were slaves. What they try to say is that, well, they were indentured servants. They were slaves. They were very badly treated. Right, there were people without a home, they were stolen from their homes, they were killed, they were slaughtered, they were taken, and they were forced to be slave labor. Now, what people don't know is on June 20th, 1631, an invasion force of pirates on the Barbary Coast, Barbary Coast of North Africa, backed by elite troops of the Turkish Ottoman Empire, stormed ashore at the quiet village of Baltimore in Ireland, also known as the Stolen Village of Baltimore. They abducted nearly every villager for sale on slave markets. Two Baltimore men were killed as they made a bid to stop 230 armed invaders, Islamic invaders. Now, this scene is almost forgotten today, right? And it's one of the most devastating invasions of the island of Britain by Islamic forces. 107 people, mostly women and children, were herded like cattle and taken to a life of slavery in Algiers. Only two or perhaps three of them ever saw their home again. Now, these weren't Irish people. These were actually English people who had rented the port. These were fishermen. Now, what is interesting, notice Murat Rais, the Islamic pirate captain who led slave raids as far as Iceland, was a middle-class Dutchman who had converted to Islam.
Yeah.
So this was a middle-class Dutchman who had converted to Islam. Now, notice how many converts to Islam suddenly have a hatred of white people. Sinead O'Connor, we're looking at you.
yeah. Wow, she's lost her marbles.
Yeah, or others that suddenly start wanting to commit jihad because now they've converted and people wonder what the hell just happened. But this is a Dutchman who converts to Islam and becomes one of the most feared pirates on the seas at the time. Now, there is no William Wilberforce or Bartolomeo de las Casas in Islamic history, as there is in Christian history or Western history, that sought to end the slave trade. Now, often when we ask who was the Muslim abolitionist, we hear, no, Muhammad, you know, but he was a slave owner. He was a slave trader. He captured and sexually exploited slaves, and he left a 13th century legacy of divinely sanctioned slavery. So how is he an abolitionist? So now the more we get into the study of Islam, the more we realize that the history we teach ourselves has been artificially edited in order to remove Islam from it. So the story we're told about slavery in America is that evil white men are on wooden ships. And I have to thank Bill Warner. He's done some brilliant research in this regard. There are many, many, there are about five people that I read, whose research I use. Bill Warner is one of the preeminent researchers in this field. So we're told white men on wooden ships got slaves off the coast of Africa and brought them to America and sold them. Now, there is some truth to this, but also there are parts that are missing. How did the slaves get into the slave pens? How did they come from the middle of Africa to the coasts? Right, the captains of these ships did not capture them. The Americans who went out to get slaves simply bought them at slave auctions, slave markets. They did not go and capture slaves themselves. So they handed over money, they received a bill of sale, and they got an invoice. And the slaves were brought from the heart of Africa. They weren't taken from the coast. They were brought to the coast to be sold. And there was a book written by David Livingstone in 1888. Now, David Livingstone was an abolitionist missionary, Central Africa, and he recorded what this process of taking slaves was like. And this is where it is relevant to understand.
And that's not the David Livingstone I've had on my show.
This is the David Livingstone of Sir David Livingstone, I presume. You may have heard that little legend that he was found in Zimbabwe at the Victoria Falls by, was it Zim? Yeah. So David Livingstone writes about this in his diaries in the 1800s. So no, the internet wasn't that great back then. So I'm going to read a few passages. It's a fairly lengthy section, but I want to thoroughly cover this subject because I want to point the finger of blame where it also belongs and have people understand the depth of what was the depth of depravity that was going on here. David Livingstone wrote, "Wherever we took a walk, human skeletons were seen in every direction. The site of this desert, but 18 months ago, a well-peopled valley, now literally strewn with human bones, forced the conviction upon us that the destruction of human life in the Middle Passage, however great, constitutes but a small portion of that waste." So the Middle Passage was the passage from Africa to America. Slaves were treated badly and many died. But he says that no matter how many died in the Middle Passage, far more were killed in the process of taking slaves. From what we know, statistically, for every 12 slaves taken, only one made it to Arabia. So we're looking at an attrition rate of 11 to 1.
Wow.
So, and that's from Africa to Arabia. Going across the Middle Passage, we're looking, I think, a 5 to 1 death rate. So it took 6 slaves for one to get to America. So the Arabs were holding and capturing these slaves in such a brutal fashion.
Let me ask you something. Let me just interject here. What can you say about, you know, for instance, it's very common in the United States for Black Americans to take on Islam and reject Christianity as being suppressive. What do you say about that?
Well, you know, when you critique Islam, you get told, well, you need to read Arabic. But when you join Islam, no one makes that demand. No one tells you you have to understand Arabic to understand Islam. To become a Muslim, all you have to say is the Shahada. And that's it. You're a Muslim now. So you say a short sentence 3 times and Bob's your uncle. There you go. There is no requirement to actually study. And in fact, you are generally discouraged from studying these things. They're being lied to. People are being lied to. It's that simple. And if people understood the truth, they wouldn't join Islam. If people understood the history of Islam, if this would honestly taught in school, people would have a very different view. I think they should understand that they need to genuinely study history without bias. Go look at the facts of themselves, verify what I'm saying, if it's true or not. You know, I'm trying to present the truth as I've researched it. And it is not the religion of Black people. I don't think so.
Yeah, considering that they were enslaved more brutally in Islamic countries than anywhere on the world, and that the white Christians fought harder than anyone else to end slavery, how could they possibly say that, you know, like, oh shoot, now I can't even think of his name. You know, this 60s leader that led a lot of Blacks into Islam.
Not Farrakhan?
Yeah, thank you so much.
Exactly. Nation of Islam?
Yep.
Yeah. Discussion.
It becomes absurd when you realize.
Look, it is. It is. I am aware from my work in security that a number of well-known Black celebrities have become Muslims, that have either joined mainstream Sunni schools or Sunni sects, or they've joined with Farrakhan, but they've kept it very quiet. I do know about that. That's a discussion we can have offline. Yeah, some of these things, I don't understand it, but it's not simply, it's based on the lie. They were told a lie and they believed it. So Livingstone goes on. They rescued a small group of slaves. Many of the party were children, about 5 years or even less. 2 women had been shot the day before for attempting to untie their thongs in order they might rest. 1 woman had her infant's brains knocked out because she couldn't carry both it and her load. And a man was dispatched with an axe because he had broken down with fatigue. We passed a slave woman shot or stabbed through the body lying on the path. It was said that an Arab who had passed earlier that morning had done it in anger at losing the price he had given for her because she was unable to walk. Now, the man who did this killing is described as an Arab, yet this man is Muslim. So we read the history and we find that Islam is not mentioned. It's been whitewashed. Jihad is not mentioned. And Muslims are not mentioned. Islam's not mentioned. Yet all of these are involved. So he notes that not more than 1 in 5 ever reached the slave masters in Cuba. Right? That's the slaves going west. So 1 in 5 survives being taken from the village to the slavery in America. Right? So that's collateral damage of 80%. Right? So we had a long discussion about the slave trade, he goes on. The Arabs have told the chief that their object in capturing slaves is to get them into our possession and make them of our own religion. That religion is Islam. Notice again, it is not mentioned. The evils we have seen, the skulls, the ruined villages, the numbers who perish on the weight of the coast and the sea, the wholesale murders committed by the Wahyu tribe who were allies, I think I've spelled that one wrong, who were allies with the Muslims to build up Arab villages elsewhere. Why are they capturing these men? Not only to convert them to Islam, but in order to get their wealth so they can take it back to their villages. Right? The strangest disease I've seen in this country really seems to be brokenheartedness, and it attacks free men who have been captured and made slaves. They ascribe their pain to their heart. It really seems that the broken heart is the reason that they die. The Arabs would often promise a present to the villagers if they would act as a guide to some distant point. But as soon as they were far enough away from their friends, they were seized and penned into slave sticks or yokes from which there was no escape. So there's a brutality here which is not openly discussed in history. So we see the brutal process in which slaves are made by the practice of jihad against non-Muslims. So Muslims are supposed to capture non-Muslims, kafirs, and make slaves of them. But we also know there's a large body of Sharia law cases in which black African Muslims complain in courts that the Muslim slave traders will take black African Muslims if they can't find kafirs. So once you're running the slave business, you're not supposed to capture your own, but in order to stay in business, well, if you're a slaver, you're a slaver, and that's what you do. So Muslims ran the slave trade on the west coast of Africa. They also ran it on the Mediterranean coast and the east coast of Africa. So the missing part of the story of slavery in America is this. It was Muslims who captured the Africans to bring them to sell to the white man, to bring them to America. So Muslims tell black Americans that Islam is the religion of the black man, whereas Christianity is the religion of the white man. Yet we see it was Africans being captured by Islamic slave traders who started the whole process. Now, what else do we not know about history simply because it involves Islam? Okay, and this is where I get into my part about doctrine. Was there any questions?
I don't see any good questions in the chat here. A couple of trolls and whatnot.
Are people looking
people
aggrieved?
Are just having a normal conversation. They're not freaking out like in the first episode.
Okay, that's good to know. So, so a couple of things. Slavery. The concept of slavery is different in Islam than it is in the West. For instance, Islam is a form of spiritual slavery. It's a form of, it's submission. It is to submit or to surrender, right? So obviously, if you look at the name Abdullah, which is slave of Allah, Abd, slave of Allah, right? I did mention to you earlier, and I'll throw this in again, Abdullah was the name of Muhammad's father, which obviously tells us that Allah, as a deity, was actually around before Muhammad was born, right? So we spoke previously about that the Allah for the region, now every village had its Allah, the God. However, the Allah for the region, for that area, Arabia, was the Nabataean God, right? He was the Allah. When people mentioned the Allah as opposed to a specific God, because Allah is a descriptor, they were referring to the Nabataean God of the kings. The Nabataean God of the kings, as I discovered recently, because I've been doing some research, Dan Gibson speaks about this very eloquently to speak about Hubal, because we've mentioned Hubal before. Hubal is the Nabataean God of the kings. He was the Allah for Arabia. And Hubal is made up of two words, Hubal. So the second part of that name is the god Baal. Perhaps you want to throw in a few words there.
Yeah, because, well, I mean, you know, Baal is in the same category, or Baal is in the same category as Moloch, Satan, etc. So, you know, that should wake people up. And right there you've got little Moloch, you know, down there, Ibn Abi Zayd, You know, that's interesting because Malek and Molek, a very similar pronunciation, but never
well, now, one thing that's interesting is that the symbol for Hubal was, as far as I know, from what I've been researching, you might remember there's the very famous satanic symbol of the goat with the hand, one hand up and the one hand pointing down. That is also the symbol for Hubal. It's a god with one hand up, holding something and one hand pointed down. So just these references, the things that overlap, I'm not making a definitive statement there, but it's something people can look at and something to think about. Okay, so Muhammad's father, Abdallah, slave of Allah, so Hubal, right there. A common term in Islam is those whom your right hand possess. This is your sword hand. The right hand is your sword hand. And this generally refers to slaves. Who your right hand possesses is a slave, and it generally tends to refer to women. Right? Islam divides people between Muslims and the Kafir, Islam and Kufr, Islam submission, and people who reject Islam, right? People who refuse to submit. It also divides people between free people and slaves and males and females. So let's start looking at slavery in Islamic scripture and in Sharia doctrine, because I wanted to provide some brief historical background. O ye who believe, the law of equality, qisas, is prescribed to you in cases of murder, the free for the free, the slave for the slave, the woman for the woman. That is from Quran 2:178. The message of this verse prescribes the rule of retaliation for murder. Okay, all humans, it also says that all humans are not created equal. The human value of a slave is less than that of a free person, and a woman's worth is also distinguished from that of a man. It is not equal. So, there are four schools of Sunni jurisprudence. We spoke about that last week. Imam Malik is the guy who founded the Maliki school of jurisprudence. Imam Shafi, Imam Layth, Imam Ahmad bin Hanbal from the Hanbali school, and Imam Abu Tawr said, a free man is not killed for killing a slave. Now, why would slavers murder so many black people? Why would they murder so many of their slaves? Well, there's no penalty for it. There is no penalty. Because if you own that slave, you can kill that slave without penalty. Imam Abu Hanifa and his followers said, a free man is killed for killing a slave, except if the slave belongs to him, the free man. Now, this one is the one who dissents. Now, remember, the tafsir is the interpretation. Literally, tafsir, interpretation. It's the form of exegesis. Now, tafsir also is used to, when Muslims speak about, well, it depends how it's interpreted. So we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 imams who say a free man is not killed for killing a slave. And we have the dissenter, which is Imam Abu Hanifa here, who still agrees with that in substance, okay? Except, so you...
Now,
so
let me just interject there really quickly, Lloyd. As far as I recall, in most areas in the United States and in Christian countries, it was illegal to kill your slaves. It was considered murder.
Correct. Under Islam and the Sharia law, it is not considered murder. The only distinction was by Imam Abu Hanifa, who said that killing someone else's slaves is illegal, but killing your own slaves is just fine. So, Tafsir of Imam Qurtubi, okay, the Jami Ahkam al-Quran, and I'm probably slaughtering that, the majority of our scholars are of the opinion that a free man is not killed for killing a slave because of the classifications and divisions of people, okay? And there's no law of retaliation between slaves and free men because of the lowliness of the person, the slave, while free men are more worthy or worth more than this. The majority of Islamic scholars are in agreement that Muslims should not be killed for killing a non-Muslim, even if he's a dhimmi. Now, when they say protected non-Muslim, it means when the mafia comes to your neighborhood and says, do you want to be protected? You know, you pay protection money, you don't get hurt. That is Islamic protection as a dhimmi. You're effectively a semi-slave and you pay them tribute or there is punishment. Nor should a free man be killed for killing a slave. The only exception of the former imams is Hanifa, but even he agrees that a master of a slave cannot be killed for killing his own slaves. Now, these texts have only been translated since the mid-2000s. So it's only since like 2003, 2005 that these texts are in English. So therefore, they haven't yet been studied extensively. People are starting to read them now. They're starting to realize, hey, these books are in English. We can read them. So Ibn Abi Zayd, known as Little Malik, And a free man is not killed for killing a slave, but a slave is killed for killing him, a free man. And a Muslim is not killed for killing a disbeliever, but a disbeliever is killed for killing a Muslim. There is no retaliation for injuries. So notice that this is an extension of the old law, which is an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, right? Blood for blood, so on. This is very different to the Western concept. First, you look at the Christian concept, right, where the law, an eye for an eye will leave everybody blind, and this was changed. The new commandment I give unto you, love thy, you know, you'd know more about that than I do. But this is retaliation. This is a very brutal series of laws contained in the Sharia, which are still extant today. They're still enforced today. They can never be changed. Goes on, Imam Shafi states the following in his Kitab al-Umm. In a believer, whether a slave or a free man or woman, is never killed for killing a disbeliever under any condition. A free man is not killed for killing a slave under any situation. And if a free dhimmi kills a slave as a believer, even then he is not killed for it. Interesting. So now we have the Umdat al-Salik, the reliance of the traveler. Qisas is obligatory on whoever kills a person purely intentionally, but there is not on a free man for killing a slave, right? Obviously, this is on the screen, so anyone can come back and read it on their own time. And nor is there any retaliation for the master for killing his slave. Al-Insaf, a renowned manual of Hanbali law, we read. Nor is a free man killed for killing a slave. And this is the correct religious belief without doubt. And this is what the colleagues believe. These would be the major imams. Read in Al-Hidayah, the classic manual of Hanafi law. And a man is not killed for killing his own slaves. So this is now, we've looked at all of the schools of Islamic jurisprudence.
Let me just read some of the comments here. Some people are saying, I have to read the other books without the Hadith and histories tafsir. You can't understand the Quran, okay? And so, again, we've already covered those books in parts one and two. And then... Yep. And then someone else says he cites multiple sources as well as the original, despite the fact that Islam is designed to not be interpreted.
And it is not being, well, look, tafsir means literally the word means interpretation, right? These are the opinions or the findings of very, very senior scholars who have created what's called the Islamic consensus, the ijma. So these are the men who've defined the consensus. So for instance, all agree that you can, let's take adultery, right? You talk about consensus and interpretation. All of them agree that there's punishment for adultery. The difference is in how the punishment is meted out. Do you whip her to death? Do you stone her to death? Or do you lock her up until she dies of starvation? That's where the dispute is, not about whether this person dies or is punished. You know, so there's a difference there. Let me just grab this screen and place it over here where I can see it. So, sorry, did that answer the question that just came up, Jan?
Yeah.
Or did I drift off point?
Yeah, I think you got it. That's fine.
So, look, this is. I went and looked at what the scholars, the Islamic scholars, who define all of the Sharia. These are the opinions of the top scholars who founded these Islamic schools of jurisprudence. This is what they say. I'm just repeating what they're saying. So if you look at now, let's start looking at some of the Quran, because I knew that was going to come up. So I've got the Quran. So first we have the top Islamic scholars, the very best Islamic scholars. These are their opinions. I've just mentioned those. O Prophet, we have made lawful to thee thy wives and those slaves whom thy right hand possesses out of the prisoners of war that Allah has assigned to thee. So if a woman is taken as part of a battle, she becomes your slave, and she becomes also your sex slave. This is one of several personal sounding verses, right? This is where Allah seems to be talking directly to Muhammad, and where he is favored. And in this case, it allows an unlimited supply of sexual partners. Other Muslims are restricted to four wives, but they may also have sex with any number of slaves. Now notice, this stipulation was given to Muhammad. Later on, when there's a complaint from his followers, they receive a similar command from Allah that says that they too can have an unlimited supply of sex slaves. So, Quran 23:5-6, those who abstain from sex except with those joined to them in marriage or the captives whom their right hands, this is Quran, as I said, look this up yourself, who their right hands possess. This verse permits the slave owner to have sex with these slaves. I don't know how their wives feel about that, but that's how it is. Quran 70:29. And those who guard their chastity, i.e. private parts from illegal sexual acts, adultery is a crime. Remember, adultery is a crime in Islam. It's not a sin, it is a crime. And then 70:30, except with their wives and their women, slaves, and captives whom their right hands possess. For them they are not blamed. In other words, having sex with captured women is not an illegal sexual act.
And let me just read from my Tajweed Quran here, that 23:56. Who abstain from sex except for those who join in them with marriage bond, or the captives, it says, whom their right hand possesses, for in their case they are free from blame. So
yeah.
that's from this edition right here.
Yeah, I mean, you can hold the page up and people can see that it's written on that page, right? You didn't make it up.
Let me hold that up for people to see that. In English right there and in Arabic.
So
if we're making it up, why are all of the Qurans and everything, why are all of the official citations showing this? You know, and I showed the certifications last week of this Quran being official. There it is there.
Yeah. If people want, I can also show the certifications of the Umdat al-Salik, or Reliance of the Traveler, which is the most endorsed, most authentic Sharia manual on the face of the planet. I mean, those endorsements are there as well, the certifications. Anyone can ask me, I'll send them a copy. What the heck? So, all married women are forbidden unto you, save those captives whom your right hands possess. So even sex with married slaves is permissible. That is Quran 4:24. Now let's look at Quran 8:69. But now enjoy what you took in war, lawful and good. So what is captured? Now remember, these are the eternal, perfect, unchangeable words of Allah, right? And this is also part of the example, the Sunnah of Muhammad, which can never be changed, never be questioned, never be altered. And this made into the Sharia, which is the law of Allah. So it can never be changed. That would be bid'ah. That would be innovation. That's a crime as well. So war booty is... Chapter 8 actually covers quite a bit about booty, which is basically things, spoils of war. And women slaves are part of that. And Quran 24:32, because I want to nail this home and drive this home, and marry those among you who are single and those who are fit among your male slaves and your female slaves. So now we have breeding slaves based on fitness. Quran 16:75, Allah sets forth the parable of two men. One a slave under the dominion of another. He has no power of any sort, and the other a man on whom we have bestowed goodly favors for ourselves. And he spends, so slavery, you know, slaves, man as, there we go, slaves. One slave under the dominion of another. Allah has preferred, Quran 16:71, and Allah has preferred some of you above others in wealth and properties. Then those who are preferred will by no means hand over their wealth and properties to slaves whom their right hands possess, so that they may be equal with them. In other words, do they deny the favor of Allah? In other words, you insult Allah by bestowing Allah's gifts on slaves, those whom the God of Islam has not favored. You will by no means hand over wealth and property to slaves so that they may be equal with you, because a slave is not equal with you. Okay, you can always look up the tafsir. Actually, let's have a look here. In terms of the tafsir, when I click on this link, we come here to Quranex. Okay, now it is worth getting multiple opinions. So if we look at Quranex here, there's roots, and here you see this says tafsirs, and we can click on that and we go to tafsirs. Often, a verse will actually also have hadith associated with it. So if you go to Quranex.com, you type in the verse, you will then also be offered to look at the hadith associated with that, if they exist. Sahih Bukhari. So now we come to the most authentic hadith collection. Sahih Bukhari 41:598. Slaves are property. They cannot be freed if an owner has outstanding debt, but they can be used to pay off the debt. So from volume 3, book 41, hadith number 598. A man narrated Jabir. A man manumitted or freed a slave, and he had no other property. So the prophet canceled the slave's freedom, he canceled the manumission and sold the slave for him. And this guy, bought the slave from him. So the prophet canceled the freedom of a slave that a man had freed and then sold that slave into who knows what fate. So that starts to really contradict the idea that Muhammad was the man who freed slavery, who abolished slavery, who abandoned slavery. Now, Muhammad had freed slaves, a slave, sure, freeing a slave, but not all slavery. He did not abolish or ban slavery. Sahih Bukhari, women taken as slaves in battle by Muhammad's men after their husbands and fathers were killed. The women are then raped with Muhammad's approval. Volume 7, Book 62, Number 137. I will click on this. We'll go to the site, and you can see that it is exactly as I said it. It's right there. So the sources are real. Narrated Abu Sa'id al-Khudri. We got female captives in the war booty, and we used to do coitus interruptus with them. So we asked Allah's apostle about it, and he said, do you really do that? There is no soul that is destined to exist, but will come into existence till the day of resurrection. He had no problem with his men raping slave women. He said, why do you pull out and just come inside them? Volume 3, Book 34, Number 432. While he was sitting with Allah's apostle, he said, O Allah's apostle, get female captives. We get female captives as our share of booty, and we are interested in their prices. What is your opinion about coitus interruptus? Simply because a slave who fell pregnant was worth less than one who was not pregnant. Right. The prophet said, do you really do that? It is better for you not to do it. No soul. In other words, hey, dude, have your way. Don't worry about it. Make her pregnant. It's okay. Sahih Bukhari 47, 765. A woman is rebuked by Muhammad for freeing a slave girl. The prophet tells her that she would have gotten a greater heavenly reward by giving her to a relative as a slave. Narrated Qurib, the freed slave of Ibn Abbas, told him that she manumitted a slave girl without taking the permission of the prophet. On the day when it was her turn to be with the prophet, she said, do you know, Allah's apostle, I've manumitted my slave girl. He said, have you really? She said, yes. He said, you would have got more reward if you had given the slave girl to one of your uncles. Muhammad sells a slave for money, therefore he was a slave trader. Volume 3, Book 34, Number 351 in Sahih Bukhari. A man decided that a slave would be manumitted after his death, and later on he was in need of money. So the prophet took the slave and said, who will buy this slave from me? And the slave was bought. Okay, this is one of many places where reference is made to a human being owned by Muhammad. Okay, so, I deleted that one. That was another one, just getting too many. So Sahih Bukhari 72, 734, a slave opens the door for someone who's visiting Muhammad, and they mention that Muhammad had a slave who was taking care of the household. So this is just one of many places where there is a slave that Muhammad owns, and apparently a slave of African descent. So the myth then, a prophet never approved of slavery. Okay, he once purchased the life of a slave who came to him, liberating him from his master. Now, this is a common this form of deception. They'll say, but Muhammad freed the slaves. No, he freed a slave. And let us look. Muhammad was cheated.
A slave.
Yeah, but he was cheated. Okay, he was fooled, and he said he wouldn't make that mistake again. So here's the story on which this legend of Muhammad liberating a slave is based. And this is commonly used by Muslims to say, well, look at how good Muhammad was. So there came a slave, and he pledged allegiance to Allah's apostle on migration. And he, the holy prophet, did not know that he was a slave. Then came the slave master and demanded him back, whereupon Allah's apostle said, sell him to me, because effectively he'd already allowed the slave his freedom to go on migration. So Muhammad said, sell him to me. So he bought the slave, and he bought him for two black slaves. So he traded two black slaves that Muhammad owned for this slave. And he did not afterwards take allegiance from anyone until he had asked him whether or not he was a slave or a free man. Sahih Muslim 3901. So Muhammad purchased the slave by trading two black slaves, which established that Muhammad owned and traded black slaves, African slaves. Now, he was a wealthy warlord. He could have liberated all three slaves, but he chose to sell two Africans into an uncertain future with this man. It's also obvious that Muhammad felt he had been conned into liberating the slaves who had come to him, the slave who had come to him, since he was not told of his status as a slave, and he decided he would not be duped again. Okay. Now the apostle gave Ali, his son, a girl called Raita, and he gave Uthman, one of the caliphs, a girl called Zainab, and he gave Umar, another caliph, a girl whom Umar gave to his son Abdullah. And this is an Ibn Ishaq, 878, and also mentioned Ibn Khatir, volume 3, page 481. So Muhammad gave slaves as favors, gold slaves, women slaves as favors. Okay, so we're getting towards the end. This is, we are covering, just strictly going through the scriptural references on the doctrine. The Prophet sent for a woman from whom the emigrants, and she had a slave who was a carpenter. The Prophet said, order your slave to prepare the wood pieces for the pulpit. And the slave built the pulpit that Muhammad used to preach from. The Prophet lifted it and placed it at the place in which you see now. That's Bukhari 47.743. So, Sahih Muslim 33.71. Muhammad and his men take captive some excellent Arab women from the Banu Mustalik. The dilemma then becomes that they want to rape the women because they missed their wives. I don't know what their wives would say about that, but okay. But they also want to ransom the women, and they know that the captives will be of less value if pregnant. So they ask Muhammad about it. Abu Sirmah said to Abu Sa'id al-Khadri, Allah be pleased with them. Oh, Abu Sa'id, did you hear Allah's messenger mentioning al-Azl, which is basically coitus interruptus, or withdrawal before climax? He said, yes, we went out with Allah's messenger on the expedition to the Bilal Mustalik, to the Bilal Mustalik, and took captive some excellent Arab women. We desired them, for we were suffering from the absence of our wives. But at the same time, we also desired ransom from them, so we decided to have sexual intercourse with them. There is no mention here of what the women thought about that, if the women decided that was a good idea. Because in Islam, the slave doesn't have a say in the matter. But by observing Azul,
so basically, okay, they go out, capture some free women, make them slaves, then rape them, and then say it's justified because now they're slaves.
Correct. Correct. We'll get into that. I'll get more into that. We're nearing the end here. So, yes. So, we are doing an act, whereas Allah's messenger is amongst us. Why not ask him? So, we asked Allah's messenger, and he said, it does not matter if you do not do it. In other words, don't pull out. Just come inside them. For every soul that is to be born after the day of resurrection will be born. Now, I spent 6 hours preparing this, going through, oh my God, the volume of stuff that I had to cut out and decide what gets included and what gets left out. I mean, it was such a massive mountain, and I wanted to make a short presentation. But this is a just a glimpse into what is actually there. So Abu Dawood, 1814, Abu Bakr. So let's look at some of the treatment of slaves. Now, I have heard many times in my debates online that under Islam, slavery is an honorable thing. Slaves are treated well. Things are nonsense. Nonsense. Okay. Abu Bakr was one of the caliphs. Okay. He was the father of Aisha, Muhammad's wife, the young girl that he married at 6. And kitty fiddled from that point onwards until he slept with her at 9. He then began to beat his slave while the apostle of Allah was smiling. So Abu Bakr began to beat his slave while the apostle of Allah was smiling and saying, look at this man who is in the sacred state. What is he doing? So the future first caliph of Islam is beating a slave for losing a camel while Muhammad looks on in amusement. Right?
Wow.
This is the example of Muhammad. This is the sunnah of Muhammad. This is the perfect Muslim, the perfect man, the perfect moral and legal example in Islam. Ibn Ishaq, 734. A slave girl is given a violent beating by his son Ali in the presence of Muhammad, who does nothing. When Muhammad's favorite wife, Aisha, was accused of adultery. Oh, yeah, that happened. I don't know how many. Yeah, let's go on. He launched an investigation that included the brutal interrogation of a female slave. So the apostle called Buraira to ask her, and Ali got up and gave her a violent beating, saying, tell the apostle the truth. It doesn't record that Muhammad got up and said, hey, you can't beat a woman, because I believe I covered in full previously that the Quran, the Hadith, the Sharia, all very clearly allow the beating of women. I think I made that very clear in the first show that we did. I discussed those references, and I will come back to that. I will come to women.
And as well as the enslaving, raping at all, which we're seeing all across Europe, you know, now.
Yes. this would begin to explain the problems with the what they call the euphemistically the grooming gangs in Europe, because every mosque that goes down is captured territory. It is colonization.
I hope and there's quite a number of Muslims in the audience right now, and we have one former Muslim whom I hope chimes in soon. He's posting, but he's not giving much right now. But I hope all of you sit down and read the New Testament. It's only 400 pages, and compare Jesus Christ and living in truth and being the utmost moral person to Muhammad, and just look at the contrast. And, you know, I mean, that's, you can't deny these citations. I mean, every one of these citations, I don't have all of the books that Lloyd has, but every time I've pulled up my Quran here, his citations are there, and I've shown them on screen right out of this book as well. I mean, you know, come on, people, really. You know, I don't know what kind of cognitive dissonance you're having, but you need to think about this stuff. I mean, the contrast is stark, to say the least.
Yeah. So we're very near the end of this section. As I said, I struggled to exclude stuff. There was just so much. Abu Dawood 1:142. And it says, "Do not beat your wife as you beat your slave girl." He then said, actually, I'll just go to that link. This one is on muflihun.com, and there's others. So I use different sites. I double check these on sunnah.com. There's also another famous site, Sunnah. I showed that last week. So yeah, I go to different sites, and this is sunnah.com. He said, "Then ask her to obey you, and if there's something good in her, she will do so. Obey, and do not beat your wife as you beat your slave girl." And you know, there was a quote that I had in the first one, which also spoke of, do not whip your wife, or do not beat your wife as you beat your slave girl, and then have sex with her in the last part of the day. That's another Quranic reference. I didn't include that. I showed that before, but do not beat your wife as you beat your slave girl, and then have sex with her in the last part of the day. You know, I read this, and I can't believe I'm reading this sometimes. Ibn Ishaq, 693. Then the apostle sent blah, blah, blah,
interject here. Okay, one of the Muslims.
This is the end, so I'm very new. Yeah, go on.
All right, I just want to say this. People who rape do not follow Islam. They normally drink alcohol and do not pray.
Then Muhammad was drunk. His companions were drunk. Ali was drunk. Abu Bakr was drunk. You name it. All of them were drunk. And then also all of the imams who wrote the schools of jurisprudence must also all have been drunk for allowing this.
I just don't understand. How are people in such denial when we're reading the primary citation? Simply for Women, are you a troll? Are you just having cognitive dissonance? I don't grasp how you can look at all of these primary citations on screen and sit here and deny over and over and over for three episodes. All, you know, what's going on in your head? Stop. This is the last time I'm going to tell you. The next time, I'm blocking you. I'm done.
Yeah. Look, drinking is a sin in Islam. I mean, I can mention some stuff about wine. Actually, the whole thing about wine proves the concept of abrogation, the doctrine of abrogation, the principle of abrogation, that newer verses cancel out older verses. There's actually a verse in the Quran where wine has some benefit. Okay, so that's one of just a quote, and I will say I'm picking now just a tiny piece from that particular verse. But as you said, the words are that wine has some benefit, and then later on, wine is haram, right? It is not permitted; it's no longer halal. So that new stipulation cancels out the old stipulation that wine has some benefit. But that's something I can tackle that next time, because it's just one of those really like what the heck did I just read kind of things.
Right.
Yeah. So look, were they drunk? Well, then these are the companions. These are, again, the sunnah of the companions and the sunnah of Muhammad. Oh, if they were drinking, then isn't that the way forward? It doesn't make sense. I mean, the denial. This is what they did. you know, I had to remove things from this list. I mean, I had so much, I had to cut this down. I was like, what do I leave in? What do I take out? You know, Ibn Ishaq, 693. Okay. So he sent Abdul Ashar with some of the captive women of the Banu Qurayza to Najd, and he sold them for horses and weapons to fund his jihad, to fund his war against the unbeliever, to fund his war. In the first 300 years of Islam, they went from Arabia to Paris. Okay, they took their armies from Arabia to Paris. And if they weren't stopped by Charles Martel, you know, Western Europe by now would have been Islamic. And then Eastern Europe, if they weren't stopped by the Poles and the Hajduks, the Serbs, would have been Islamic. I mean, it's insane.
The Serbs just took a brutal beating fighting them back too.
Well, it was a Pyrrhic victory. I mean, they won, but they lost everything. They were so weakened. But the thing is, it was a sacrifice that was necessary because it weakened the Islamic forces enough to give the rest of Europe time to regroup, just as the Crusades did. The Crusades was a war, a defensive war after 400 years of Islamic aggression, and it gave Europe a 200-year breathing room to establish itself, build its armies, build its wealth, so that they could withstand the Islamic invasion. If the Crusades had not happened, there would be no opposition because they took the fight to the enemy. And you know what?
Let's do this. On the next episode, let's talk about the Crusades and the wars, because when we lay all of that out, you know, because the Muslims like to play the victim card on that as well about the Crusades. And when we start to look at what really happened and why the Crusades happen, it paints a very different picture. Maybe we should do that for part four.
Yeah. No, I want people to look at what I'm showing them, to go study the history. And this is how slave women are treated and slaves are treated. And this will also, I mean, once we start to eventually talk about women, but the what Islam says about women, I mean, it's just, yeah. So Muhammad trades away women, okay, from the captured from the Banu Qurayza tribe to non-Muslim slave traders for property. Their men had been executed after surrendering peacefully without a fight. Okay, that's a very well-known story. I'm not going to go into that now, but he sold them. He sold these slaves for horses and weapons, basically to fund his army. So he had no compunction about that. Now look, people will say, but everybody had slaves. Yes, every single culture on earth had slaves, and Islam had a 1,300-year slave trade that has not ended yet. And Westerners were in the slave trade for 300 years, and they ended it. For instance, the British traveled around the world. The Brits only paid off the debt that they incurred from the abolition of slavery. So the British efforts of abolition, the debt they incurred was only paid off in 1980.
Wow.
Right, that was a debt that they incurred in the 1800s. Was only paid off in 1980, and they sent their ships around the world. Their navy went around the world freeing slaves, stopping piracy, getting these slaves free. If you look at the American War, the North-South War, 700,000 Americans died in the process of freeing 350,000 black slaves. You know, that's insane. That's insanity. But that was a completely different legal and moral base, a completely different religious base than what Islam is based on. So on the Umdat, so coming to the end now of this whole section dealing with the scripture and the doctrine, in the Umdat al-Salik, the reliance of the traveler, the sacred manual of Islamic law, in section 09.13, according to Sharia, when a child or a woman is taken captive by Muslims, they become slaves by the mere fact of their capture. A captured woman's previous marriage is immediately annulled.
Wow.
This would not be necessary if she were widowed by battle. Okay. So this is now the apologists. Now I want the apologists often come out, yeah, but you know, she's widowed by battle. No, if she's captured, she's no longer a married woman, and that's it. So let's look at the reliance of the traveler, section 04.9. The indemnity paid for a Jew or a Christian. I mean, I can go to the book. We can look at the reference that exists. That's real. I can send you a copy of the book, whatever. So the indemnity paid for a Jew or a Christian is 1/3 of the indemnity paid for a Muslim. So under the Sharia, Jews, for Christians are worth one third of that of a Muslim. Okay, that's in law, that's in whatever. The indemnity paid for a Zoroastrian is 1/15 of a Muslim. When a miscarriage results from someone having struck the stomach of a pregnant woman or other part of her, or when someone frightens her, resulting in a miscarriage, the indemnity for the fetus is a male or female slave worth 1/20 of the indemnity payable. Okay, so have a look here. I copied this from the actual book itself. This is a screen cap from the book. The indemnity paid for a Judeo-Christian is 1/3. Let's go on. Reliance of the traveler, section 09.13. And this is the best laid out Sharia manual there is. It's really excellent the way it's indexed. When a child or a woman is taken captive, they become slaves by the fact of capture, and the woman's previous marriage is immediately annulled. And that is right here. Reliance of the traveler, section 09.14. When an adult male is taken captive, the caliph considers the interests of Islam and the Muslims, and decides between the prisoner's death, his slavery, his release without paying anything, or ransoming him in exchange for money or for a Muslim captive held by the enemy. Now, historically, one may have heard of a group of monks that were called the ransomers. The ransomers would collect money, then go to the Holy Lands and the Middle East and try to free the slaves, and sometimes offer themselves as sacrifice to take over, you know, to free these people and offer themselves in slavery. So that's where the idea of the ransomer came from, because so much slavery was going on. So many slaves from Europe were taken to Africa. So there was more slavery. There was at least six times the slavery from Europe to Africa and Arabia, or just to Africa, to North Africa, than there was from Africa to America. Six times the amount of slavery, and yet we never hear about it. They get a pass. So here we have, that's the reference. So when an adult male is taken captive, he can be killed, he can be enslaved, released, he can be ransomed or exchanged for a Muslim captive. And oh, last thing, by the way, we always get told how Islam has incredibly moral rules of war. Don't cut down a tree, don't blah, blah. It is permissible in jihad to cut down the enemy's trees and destroy their dwellings. Yes, you can cut down their trees. Stop telling me that nonsense. It's in your books. Yeah, this section, I am done. Yeah.
All right. Well, you know, we had some interesting trolls in the chat there. I had to just ban someone who keeps just going on and on and on. You know, it's like, I don't know what to say. We're showing the citations on screen, all of them over and over and over, and they're in such denial. Someone was saying, you know, people will only see what they want to see, etc. And again, they need to take that comment in themselves. Because,
why,
you know,
the
citations are
New Testament.
The citations are right here. So we're showing the actual citations from each of the books. You can check them. I don't understand what the problem is. We have to stop having cognitive dissonance. A contradiction is always a lie or an error. And those people who are acting this way, you need to ask yourself if it's our lie or your error, if you're just having cognitive dissonance. You know, we're showing the Arabic text on screen. We're showing the English translation. We're showing the citations here. There's nothing to contest. You can look all of these things up. I pulled open my Quran and showed you on camera what it said there as well. You know, it's right there. You know, it's literally right there. We have, you know, and me banning someone isn't me just, you know, censoring the troll, you know, or censoring the chat. I banned one person who's been going on and on for the last three shows like this, who won't admit one single citation or fact that we've provided, not one. And it gets really, you know, really tiring. And can you turn off your share screen if you're done there?
Oh, my bad. Sorry. Yeah, let me just do that. Sorry.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just, you know, we're trying to show what this stuff says in its own, you know, and all we've seen, all that Lloyd and I have seen, except for Abu, no one has been able to provide substantiated citations to counter any points. And then, you know, when Abu's points actually led to more proof and citations for Lloyd. So, you know, and he was the only one who provided real citations. And so, you know, people, I'm not, you know, trying to spread hate. We're just trying to get you to think. Use the Trivium method, you know. And I know that, you know, Muslims don't believe in the Holy Trinity. And I know a lot of you Muslims in my who watch my show do understand that the Trivium method is the Holy Trinity. Take that in. Understand that there are no contradictions in nature. A contradiction is always a lie or an error, and you have to take that in. So, you know, thank you again, Lloyd, for taking your time. The abuse that I've seen you receive, I mean, I've gotten about 1/10 for this series that you have, and it's been pretty bad against me as well. The name-calling, the put-downs, calling us, you know, Zionist shills, Christian Zionist shills, you know, all of it is just, it's ridiculous. It's sad.
I know, it's
pathetic.
Crazy. And but, I mean, I've been called a monkey. I've been called, I mean, a lot of very nasty names. And now apparently I work for Mossad.
Right. And you know, and these people are incapable, apparently, of reading the on-screen citations. And that's when you know that there's a problem. And,
you know, and every single book that I've referenced, I will send you. You want a copy? I'll get you one. I have them.
Please do. You know, and what, you know, we'll create a directory or something where they can download them. Rebel Lion says, honestly, I left Islam because, and he grew up in Islam because I came from a polygamous family, and my culture practices child bride taking. So I was already compelled to search for evidence to break out of the brainwashing. And you know, we haven't even gotten to that subject yet, and that is in our notes. And, you know, maybe we'll have to save that for part 5 if we're going to cover part 4.
If we're doing the Crusades, then we'll, that was the next section, but we'll push it back and I'll do the Crusades next, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, it seems that the Crusades are taking priority over that right now, but thank you, Rebel Lion, for, you know, for saying that. And, you know, and it takes a lot of nerve.
Previous comments as well.
You know, and he sent a comment earlier today or yesterday about all of this, and thank you for that. And, you know, he grew up in Islam. He grew up in the middle of it. And so, and he says he's not in North America. You know, and he received death threats for, you know, converting. And, you know, anyway, you know, take it in. You know, when was the last time you heard of, you know, a Christian who converted from Christianity getting death threats? It doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So, you know, at least not in the last several hundreds of years. So
why is there no Hindu phobia?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Why is there no Hindu phobia or Buddhist phobia or Christianity phobia, etc.? So, you know, take all of this in. Thank you, all of you. Please just be considerate. Look at the facts and the citations. If you're having cognitive dissonance, all of you that are, I recommend you take this in the most and fact check everything.
If the question does come up in the, I think, Jafari school, it's called, which is the jurisprudence for the Shia, it is identical. There is no difference. It is the same. They say the very same things. I just didn't include them because obviously the Sunnis are the major, but there is no difference.
Right. Well, and Bahare just said, if I left Islam today, my family would be fine. Well, she also lives in the United States, and she's not in the United Arab Emirates or some of these other countries, and so that's okay. That's fine. But, you know, I do recommend, Bahare, that you pick up the New Testament and read it and compare the difference, and then look at the Sharia and the Quran and the Tafsir, etc., and or Tafsir, etc., and think of these things through and just, you know, take it in. So anyway,
Ibn Kathir even wrote a book called The Battles of the Prophet. I mean, it's only about his warfare and his conduct of war. And I mean, people tell you, well, jihad, no, it's battles. Why these books? Sorry.
Yeah, no worries. Well, I think we're at a point where we can wrap it up. You know, people, please use the Trivium. Always fact check our work. That's what we provide it for. Who, what, where, when, why, and how. Always in that order. Grammar, logic, and rhetoric. Who, what, where, when is your data gathering. Why is your logic? There are no contradictions in nature. A contradiction is always a lie or an error. Fact check it and realize if it's yours or ours. And then the rhetoric. Explain, you know, the conclusion. And if you find an error, bring it to us. But so far, I don't see anybody doing that. I see a lot of name calling and cognitive dissonance, etc. But, you know, and she's saying, I'm not defending anything here. Just saying, turn that trivium on Islamic terrorism. Okay, well, we've been doing that here, but also realize that the
trivium... If you want me to do jihad, I can do a whole book on it. Seriously, my God, the mountain of citations I can provide for jihad. My gosh, we'd be here for hours.
So, yeah, and we did cover jihad in part one somewhat. If we need to do another episode going into it in more depth, maybe we should, but... Anyway, folks, I appreciate your support and, you know, everything that you can do. Logosmedia.com, TriviumEducation.com, check those out. Please do check all of our citations. Please stop the name calling. That includes you, Normalization of Ignorance, and the others out there. And we appreciate your time and support. With the other channel being shut down, we can't get super chats right now. I can't link to Patreon here, so please go to logosmedia.com and support the show. We cannot do this work without all of you, and because I was on Alex Jones twice last week, they're really trying to shut me down. The retribution for going on his show has just been incredible and ridiculous and shows how afraid and what cowards they are. So... Anyway, that's a wrap for me. And do you have anything else that you'd like to add, Lloyd?
No, that's it. There's no last minute questions. I've covered what I wanted to cover. I had some backup material if this didn't take very long, but I wanted to give this a thorough treatment.
All right.
I think I've done that.
And I agree. I would like to have Owen Benjamin on sometime when we finish this series. And all after this series, we're going to have some other stuff to cover. By a guy, Steve Jones, on Christianity, that's going to give more depth on what happened there. So, anyway, enough for tonight. Thank you, everyone in the chat, for participating. I'm glad a lot of you found us over here. Looks like about 60 of you mostly for the night, which is about a third or a quarter of what we usually get on the other channel. But the other channel is so shadow banned that it gets ridiculous as well. And let's see. And then have Adam Green on. He's been on twice already. And, you know, that's a whole other discussion. Anyway, everybody, good night. And see you next time. Until then, take care.
Good night.
Bye.